Discography, the podcast that gives Gen X music maniacs a chance to smell like teen spirit again by connecting with the brotherhood obsessed with rating the entire discography of every single artist and band that ever mattered. I'm your host, Dave Gebro, and with three new episodes each week, you're going to gain a comprehensive knowledge of an act's history and output in the time it takes to listen to one album. In this episode, we'll be turning our spray cans on Taja Cheek and Ben Chapoteau Katz of hypnotic loop-based indie darlings Lorraine, along with majestic co-host Joe Kennedy. This is one for all you super duper busy motherfuckers, because this week's a shorty. And so without further ado, away we go then with Lorraine.
At the moment, Lorraine is a three-piece band. Taja Cheek.
We play five-piece.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It's a five-piece now? Okay.
Yeah. We used to play three-piece sometimes, but four-piece was really the thing, and now it's a five-piece.
Yeah, I've seen some film of you guys playing, some YouTube stuff you guys playing as a four-piece. That was a really cool band.
I'm curious, Taja, I don't know if it's the same situation. At least your full-time job was presenting performances as an associate curator at MoMA PS1 in Queens, also leading the committee that produces Warm Up, the summer music series. Are you still doing that?
Not anymore. I stopped right before we left for tour with Animal Collective.
Okay, good. I want to ask you, though, what is the modern musician's relationship to the day job concept? You know, when you had one and you were making music, were you wrestling with it, or could you not wait to leave?
Well, I think it's more of a dichotomy that doesn't exist, and one that has been invented mostly because I think people like to categorize and understand. But for me, at least, curating was my day job, I guess, but it was also a night job and an all-the-time job because artists are not working on a clock, even if I am in an office at a specific time. But also, it's just something that was really important to me and is just something I really enjoy and pay attention to, and contemporary art is something that's important to me. But I don't think I'm alone, you know? Like, everybody I worked with, either studied as an artist or was or is an artist in some form. A lot of people I worked with were. But when you're in an institution, you know, you're sort of pigeonholed as, you know, that is your job and that is real and this other thing is a hobby, or are you making money from it, or is it this, you know? It's right. I think it's just way more complicated for a lot of people, and you know, we're made to think that if you have a day job, you're not a real musician, and that's just really, really not true. And I think it's really interesting that, you know, the biggest pop stars of our time are, you know, doing a lot of different things. And music is just one of those things.
Right.
Because they're making a lot of money and because they're everywhere, it's not seen as not doing it.
One of the things I was really psyched, Joe and I both were very psyched about talking with you about, you strike us as, very much a process freak, something we can totally relate to. So is your interest in discussing Radiohead at nauseously long length, is that because of just being a freak about the process of making music?
I don't know. I just, you know, I... again, I really respect Radiohead, especially because, you know, there are very few musicians I can point to whose music has touched me at all points of their career at some point, you know? And yeah, I think process is really important to me, but I don't really know what that means. I have a lot, because I have lots of different processes, and
seems like so do they.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. When I look at each of their records, I think the way in which they record, the limits that they place on themselves for doing that, you know, it creates creative outlets that otherwise wouldn't be there, I think. You know, looping on one, yeah, or just...
you mean changing up the process, kind of frees up their... Process, gets them, yeah, out of the box, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my writing process is like... I right now, at least, I don't want to box myself in for the future, but right now, all the music that comes from the Lorraine Project, you know, is mine, and kind of starts in a very, like... a very solitary, lonely place, at least, but like takes on all of these different lives. So all to say, like, the, you know, the process is also evolving, because it used to be very much just like in my head and me playing and doing everything myself, and you know, the circle is slowly widening, but you know, it's equal parts solo project and collaborative project and band. Just to keep it really clear as mud.
Right. When you were first starting to make music, what was that like? When you first started to make songs, you know, what were those like, and what was your process then, like, when you were first taking your first steps to make music?
It was very similar to now, honestly, because I use a lot of that material still.
Right. Interesting.
Were you working in computers at the
beginning?
Yeah.
See, that's so interesting to me, because I started learning music, you know, before the age of computers, and the younger generations, plural now, because there are several younger generations than me, all came up with computers and making music in that way. And I'm very envious. I wish I had that when I was a little kid, able to, like, the ability to make things like this by yourself, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's true. But I mean, I guess I was making music before that, right? Like, I would just like walk around with my friends and sing and harmonize. And maybe that's kind of why vocals are really important to me.
Right. And you grew up in a musical house, right?
Yes and no. My dad worked/works in music, and my mom, you know, grew up playing instruments, but it was really just with my friends where I was really making up stuff, or, you know, just making mistakes when I was practicing instruments that I had to play is where I'd start, like, making stuff up. But yeah, I don't know. The process is really very similar. It's lots of fragments, lots of recording. I just was less fearful then.
Mm-hmm. You know, in listening to both your records, I personally could not help but be reminded of the Dead circa 1968. I don't know if that was an incorrect thing. Are you at all a Dead fan or no?
I wasn't at all. I know very little about the Grateful Dead, but I did once or twice listen to Blues for Allah, and I thought it was really cool.
Yeah. Well, there's so Anthem
but
of the
like
Sun,
you know, I love Animal Collective, and like that, you know, there's a connection there, I guess. But
Anthem of the Sun has these varying layers of time overlapping. So you have studio stuff with live stuff happening at the same time. You have different Deads playing at the same time. I thought maybe it had been some kind of an influence. You know,
I work mostly in a vacuum. I feel like people are always like, what is your influence? And I was like, being alone in my room for long periods of time.
Is that where you approach songness? So what is approaching songness?
Approaching songness to me is just like, I don't know. The structure of songs like confuses me and kind of disinterests me. Disinterest is maybe the wrong word. I don't know. It's just the thing I don't concern myself with, I guess. But, you know, I really am working with just like fragments of things that really interest me. I'm the kind of person that will listen to a song and listen to like the same 10 seconds that I love over and over and over and over and over again,
mm-hmm,
rather than listening to the whole song. and yeah, like that's satisfying to me.
I get that from your music. There's definitely pieces where it's like there's like a curated moment that's kind of like stretched out in time, you know, where you like explore that little moment that you've created and build pieces around that. It's hard to pin down your influences to me. It's like I listen to music. It's like it's so unique. That really is something really super new and fresh and always surprising. It's really hard to pin down this influence. Very interesting.
And you walk this incredible knife edge of where accessibility and experimental spirit seem to be equal priorities.
Yeah, they are to me. That's I guess also where Radiohead comes in. I feel like the bands that interest me the most are, you know, I'm interested in weird stuff. Definitely. But it's less interesting to me when it's in its own vacuum. That's not true. It's cool when it's in its own vacuum also. But there's something really special that happens when weird ideas seep into the public consciousness. Mm-hmm. And that's really an interesting phenomenon to me. Because lots of other stuff happens then. And maybe this is too like optimistic, but I feel like there's like a real potential for something in that moment. And I don't exactly know what it is, but I feel like something happens where it like breaks through like the capitalist gate, or like I don't know, something happens there, or it could, and I think that's really interesting. And Radiohead is one of those bands where it's like, how, like, this is really weird. They're famous, that's cool.
So how do you, Ben, you guys start link up and you start creating things together based on Taja? You have a very insular process. So how does Ben fit into the mix? I mean, is there a standard operating procedure way that you guys will work on a song?
There's no like standard way. For me, I mean, the whole reason we met was because I was working on a live show. And to me, the live show is like a equally important but very different process. It to me, like the record is like the, to be nerdy, like the urtext, you know, like that's like the Bible. And the live show is like a extremely important but very different interpretation of that, and another way to like express ourselves that is like collaborative in a very different way. And Ben is like the engine behind that process. And the whole reason that I have a band, because I was trying to not have a band and just play with different people every time. I don't know. What do you think?
The music's too hard for you to not have a band.
Well, I was going to say, how hard is it to play these songs? Seems like they would be challenging to recreate. This isn't like a Brown Eyed Girl or something. Right. Hard to learn.
It's hard. You got to really practice it. You got to really have people who want to play the music, because they have to want to learn it correctly, because it's specific. You know, it's not just like strum this chord, just like you're saying. So, I'm sometimes referred to as the secret sauce.
Referred to. That's what you call you.
In the world where Ben, where you did not lie to Taja and tell her that you could play keyboards,
you know this story.
Is she still in a room by herself working on songs?
No. Somebody else comes along.
It just wasn't you.
That's why you gotta lie.
Yeah, it's why you gotta lie. You know,
Johnny Greenwood did something kind of similar.
Yeah, he did do something kind of similar. We glossed right over that. When he was first playing in Radiohead, didn't he
turn down his keyboard? The other keyboard player played too loud.
You know,
he didn't know how to play keyboard, so he just turned the volume all the way down.
First thing I thought of when I uncovered that information was Al Kooper with Bob Dylan in 1965 for like Rolling Stone. He couldn't play organ, and he said he could. He went out there, and that's why he actually unveiled a distinctive new sound, which was him only playing like a quarter step behind, because he had no idea how to play the organ.
Yeah, I have a friend who auditioned for kind of a popular band at the time, and he was a keyboard player, and he went and did the audition. They loved him. He got the gig, and they're like, "Do you play guitar too?" And he's like, "Oh yeah, yeah." He didn't play at all. He had to go and like buy a guitar and learn how to play that day, and like was good enough to fake his way through and do it.
But Ben, that's what you did.
You gotta seize your opportunities.
Yeah,
that's exactly what I did.
Yeah, you went out and you bought a synth, think you taught yourself to play practically overnight, didn't you?
So I knew how to play piano. So it was more learning how to. It was more learning synthesis, which mm-hmm. is important.
Well, yeah, and, you weren't lying.
Sound. I wasn't lying so much as I didn't know what I was saying.
Right.
But I knew that I didn't have a synthesizer.
I didn't know what I was saying. Nobody told me what these words meant.
yeah. No, but you know how you play an electric keyboard and it's like a piano, you know? So it's like some people say synth when they mean electric keyboard.
Right.
But she was talking, well, I got in the first rehearsal and she's talking about, can you make the sound more like a little bit rounder? And I was like, what? And she was like, maybe you could use like a triangle wave instead of a sawtooth wave. And I was like, oh, yeah. Just, just give me a second. And just like Googling sawtooth wave, like while she was looking.
Did that really happen?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God, that's really funny.
And now I love it. It's my favorite thing to do is to make sounds from scratch. Every day I do it too much. It's like a sickness. I get rid of all of my gear after every time we go on tour. I'm like, this was wrong and this was wrong, and I get new synthesizers and I start over again.
Synthesizers are a very expensive hobby. I have that hobby myself.
Oh yeah.
You know, as far as field recordings go, how much are you guys using and applying field recordings to your music?
All the time. I mean, it's either in the music or it's how I remember it. You know, I'll like wake up. I write music in my dreams a lot, but I never really remember them. It'll just be like a song on the radio in a car or something. And I'll wake up and I'll be like, oh, there's this thing. And also I'll like go in the bathroom and I'll just like mumble to myself a little bit. So there's like that kind of thing. Or like, you know, I'm walking down the street and I think lots of voice memos of me mumbling to myself. And then there's like the other stuff that actually is the source material for like manipulation of, you know, other people talking or birds chirping or, you know, whatever. Or like seltzer bubbles popping. Gotta use that one in something. Lots of stuff like that.
The 20-year package that comes out, you gotta call the bonus disc Midnight Mumbles.
That's pretty good.
One of the things that I, you know, have been pointing out as I've been really submerging myself in your music is that there's a lot of bands now that are trying to use methods of working that define a style, but they're exercises in writing. And you don't really feel like you're set adrift in the possibilities of creativity. With yours, they really feel like they're these beautiful soundscapes to get lost in, but the songs are there. Listen, you could take our word for it because we run a music podcast. So
I'll take it.
A gardening podcast, it'd be a whole different thing. Tasha, your stage name was to honor your mom, Lorraine, who passed away when you were recording the first record. So that, I can't even imagine how tough that must have been to go through. Does talking about it in interviews, does that help to kind of depersonalize it so you can assimilate the trauma and ultimately make it easier to come to terms with?
I didn't think that far ahead when I did realize that I'd have to like keep reliving it over and over again. I mean, it sort of depends on the day and my mood, you know, like grief is like a weird thing where sometimes it's great and I get to like think about her. Sometimes I like, not that I forget it's about her, but you know, like she's just so deep in it that it's like, it's not the first thing I think of. But yeah, it really kind of depends. But it also was really important to me to have the name not be the exact spelling of her name.
Right.
So I didn't want to like be her. So it's also like half this weird alter ego I used to have named L'Apostrophe, just L'Apostrophe.
Oh, nice. I like it.
And my mom's name together to create a whole new person that is both me and not me.
And so I've heard you know refer to in interviews that you've done refer a lot to demons and healing. So just as general concepts, are you talking about the trauma of going through this with your mom, or are you referring to
it's
something
pretty
else
much
completely?
Everything. It's just like you know, there's things I don't like about myself. There's things that people have told me are not good about myself. You know, we're all kind of negotiating those things. And yeah, I use music as a way to kind of like slap myself on the wrist, or to like think through things that happened, or to hopefully to like imagine alternatives, but I haven't exactly gotten there yet. It's more just like, oh, I feel this way. Like I gotta put this somewhere.
Right.
But yeah.
Maybe that is what it is. Maybe there isn't a step beyond that. It's possible that there's, the reward is in that.
I think it changes over time for sure. I mean, yeah. Your relationship with your art, I think, changes as you become a different person. You know, it means different things to you at different times, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I feel like, you know, all the self-care stuff ends up getting kind of like glossy and weird, where it's like, you just have to like exercise and eat right and you'll feel good, you know? Mm-hmm. And I want to create a space where it's okay to feel just like kind of weird and confused, because I feel like that's kind of what it feels like to try to like really figure out what's going on.
Yeah. That's self-care in its own way, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Or at least that's like, that's a part of the process, is like, sometimes it's, you feel weird, and that's okay. And I want that to be, I don't know.
I'd say if you're only sometimes feeling weird, you've beaten the system.
Yeah.
Your music is amazing. Your Pitchfork 8.5 Best New Music rating, which is, let's face it, the modern day equivalent of Johnny Carson asking you back for an encore. So... what would be the peak of adulation for you, where for you, you would know, holy shit, I have made it. I can't look down because I'm going to get dizzy.
I mean, that's what's so weird about all of this. Like, when I was making the first record, like before I even knew Ben, and it was just me and Lappin in a room, or the producer, Andrew Lappin, you know, we were kind of like, we didn't expect anybody to listen to any of this, and mostly expected it to go to be, you know, just whatever, an album that nobody really listened to. So all of this is icing on the cake for me. Right. It's sort of like, you know, anybody writing about it, going on tour with Animal Collective, I have to kind of like recalibrate what success means
in
way more meaningful ways now.
But you're playing with house money. Cool. You already won.
Yeah,
exactly. I already won. Like, if like everything goes away tomorrow and this record we're recording is like the worst thing in the world and is completely unlistenable, like, that's cool. Try again next time. I'm still happy because I didn't expect any of this to happen at all.
And so, Ben, yeah, you corroborated there in the background for a moment that you were thinking the same thing, that you didn't really see how it could possibly connect. Why was the feeling in the air, you know, as much as obviously there's conviction in the playing, why was that the common consensus?
I mean, it's not the most straightforward record in the world. It kind of requires a level of, you know, active listening, which isn't always common these days. You know, we're putting out 6-minute songs and stuff, and or did we break them up? Did we break that song up into three? I don't even remember.
Oh, no, we didn't.
No, yeah. It was like a conversation that it was like, we have to break this song up so that people can tolerate it. And then we were just like,
who cares?
We're not going to do that.
Right.
So, yeah, but, you know, it's out there. It's a little bit out there. So, you know, we just figured we'd put it out there. It's good. I'm proud of it, you know, and if people like it, that's cool, too. But no expectations, you know, can't have expectations.
You're getting notice. I mean, you're in a great position, and there's no pressure. You guys just, you know, are able to just go ahead and play in the sandbox, and it's the best possible scenario.
That's why we're like, hey, when's that next record coming out?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we like songs.
Yeah. I would only want it on my own terms, you know. Like, I don't, you know. There was only one way this was going to happen, and it's doing whatever I wanted to do.
Right, right.
I think that's why before where you were like, yeah, they didn't put that song out, and that was like wild, and I was like, yeah, I feel like we do shit like that. I feel like we make decisions like that all the time, even if it's not like putting out. It's just about doing stuff on your own terms so that you feel good about it at the end.
Right, right.
You know, like regardless of what other people says about it, you can feel good about what you did.
Well, you know? I feel you guys should feel great about what you've done. I mean, two releases to date, right? Unless I've overlooked something. Two.
Oh no, that's it.
Two records.
A whopping 1 hour or under 1 hour.
They're both an hour.
Yeah, no, it's not even an hour.
No, it's not. It's not an hour. It's like 50 and change, right? Like 56 minutes or something.
Woo!
Almost as long like as Hail to the Thief.
Records. Yeah, I went for an hour-long walk this morning and got them both in. you know, as I usually do, I usually listen to them back-to-back. Thank you so much for coming on the show. You know, this was a heck of a lot of fun. We love all of you. We really, really appreciate all of your support. And, you know, tune in, spread the word, get everything out there, get all the shows out there to your friends, loved ones, families. And we love you very much. Thank you so much, fellow soldiers of sound, for joining us on Discography.
All right, that about does it. A heartfelt Discography thanks goes out to our graphic designer, Todd Zimmer, my beautiful wife and son, Jen and Mason, Taja and Ben, the honorable Joe Kennedy, my loyal fans, and especially the entire Patreon community. I love you, and this show would not exist without you, my friends. Speaking of friends, it's high time for some new ones. They're in our Facebook group, Discography Soldiers of Sound. That's the best way to find out what's coming up on the show, but there's a hell of a lot more. You get recaps of the day in music history, the ability to pitch questions to guests, polls that put you in the driver's seat on guest and band decisions, access to a thriving creative hub if you're looking for a collaborator, and much more. So make sure you don't miss out. You can find the link to the Discography Soldiers of Sound Facebook page right there in the show notes. And if you don't mess with the Zuck, you can email me at info@discography.com and I'll keep you in the loop. But wait just a minute. This is just the entrance to the rabbit hole. Join us as we descend down, down, down on Discography's triple episode, the intro of our new Top 10 show, Deep Dive. Of course, if you're a Patreon subscriber, then you already know to keep your ears peeled throughout the week, because this Monday brings the Patreon-only wildcard episode, The Top 10 Albums to Fuck To, in which you can cut the sexual tension between myself and co-host Joe Kennedy with a plastic butter knife. Not to mention Wednesday's incredible Patreon-only episode of Discography's The Private Press, Paul Major's Top 10 Private Press Albums of all time. Definitely not one to miss. Make sure you visit patreon.com/discography and check out The Deep Dive as a Music Obsessive's Way of Life. Every week is a new thematically linked triple episode deep dive trawl. You're gonna love it. And of course, be sure to mark your calendars, because next Friday, July 28th, we're coming at you with Anthony Fantano, The Origin Story, in which we plunge to the gooey caramel center of the very real human being who's also one of today's biggest meme culture punchlines. You won't want to miss the needle drops Anthony Fantano speak from the heart about his humble beginnings. And so, from now till then, don't let our youth go to waste, lads and ladies. It's Discography.